This show furnished by Coast Psychological Services.
How well do you understand your own psychology? Are you satisfied with your relationships? Curious about how you became who you are and why you react the way you do? Well, take a seat. On the Couch with Dr. Liana, a licensed clinical psychologist, and Margaret, a trained psychotherapist, is a show about the psychology and biology of our human existence. Combining psychological research, clinical expertise, and personal life experience, Dr. Liana and Margaret get you thinking about living consciously and making positive changes in your life. Now get ready for a dose of Dr. Radio. It's On the Couch with Dr. Liana and Margaret.
On this hour of On the Couch with Dr. Liana and Margaret, sports, the all-American pastime. We love our sports. We put our kids in little leagues at 4 and 5 years old. We send them away to sports camps. Our weekends are spent wearing our favorite team's jerseys and inviting friends over to watch the game. Our newspapers are lined with sports-related news. And we cultivate relationships around our teams, making instant friends and instant communities. We may spend as little as $10 on a baseball game or thousands for playoff tickets. When our teams lose, we are sad. It impacts us in a very personal way. But sports are also a big business. 111 million people turned in to watch Super Bowl last January. Forbes estimates that the average NBA franchise is now worth $1.36 billion, and the highest paid college basketball coach gets paid $7.2 million a year. The highest paid NBA head coach earns $11 million a year. For those of you who listen to this show, you know it's a show about psychology, not sports. And tonight we are taking an inside look at the psychology behind what it's like to be a high-level athlete playing college-level and professional sports. Stay tuned because we have a very special guest, Paul Shirley. He played college basketball for Iowa State University and professional basketball player for many different teams over the years, including the Chicago Bulls, Phoenix Suns, and Atlanta Hawks, and many others. He now lives in Los Angeles, where he teaches creative writing and runs a writing workshop called Writer's Block. And perhaps you've heard of his first book, Can I Keep My Jersey? 11 teams, 5 countries, and 4 years in my life as a basketball vagabond. And he will be releasing another book soon called Stories I Tell on Dates. But before we introduce Paul, Margaret, I'm curious.
Introducing me?
I'm introducing you. Margaret Imhoff is a trained psychotherapist and communications expert. What do you think about sports, Margaret? I never found out from you. Did you watch sports or play sports when you were a kid?
Yeah, I played soccer up through. I was actually a captain of my team, captain of my soccer team in high school. But remember, it was a tiny high school. There were like 100 people in it, so it wasn't that big of an accomplishment. But I really didn't become aware of sports being a big part of American culture until I went to college. And I went to USC, so that was like the big football thing. And to be honest, I don't really enjoy football. There are probably people out there that will kill me for saying that. But even to this day, it comes up all the time. Anytime someone finds out where I went to college, they want to know, oh, you know, the football team. And I immediately dread when I say it.
Yeah.
That I don't know anything that's going on. And I know they're going to ask me.
Yeah.
So I usually have found I just ask them about it.
Yeah.
And then they tell me. And then I'm like, oh, cool. Or, oh, that's too bad. Because there's always this huge passionate opinion infused into however the team is doing, so I can just kind of pick up on that.
Yeah, I have the same experience because I went to UCLA, so same thing.
So we really,
oh, yeah.
So I shouldn't be talking to you right now.
So technically, if we were both sports fans, we wouldn't be on this show together, I guess. UCLA. I always thought it was a little bit silly, and I hope I'm not offending anybody out there by saying that. When I was a kid, my brother was fanatically obsessed with sports, and he'd have the TV on, he'd have the radio on, he'd have like a newspaper and be like looking at all of this stuff simultaneously. And I swear that the background of my like childhood was spent walking around the house hearing these sounds like, and he pitches and he scores, you know, and just psh.
Yeah.
And it would start to grate on my nerves after a while. But, you know, more so than watching sports, I think I'm interested in the psychology of sports and what that gives to us and why people are so consumed by sports. And it's interesting to think about what it really means and what it represents for people in their lives.
It is really interesting. And I mean, we can talk about, you know, what it means to society. But I think when you play sports, I mean, even when I play sports now for fun with my friends, just kicking a ball around, it's really, there's a feeling to it. There's a camaraderie. It's something really powerful. There's something really powerful about it for people. What do you think it is psychologically that really drives people to feel so connected to different athletes, or should we save that later for our guest?
Yeah, well, we'll certainly speak in more detail about that with Paul. But, I was thinking about the concept of the hero,
mm-hmm.
or the archetype of the hero, and what that represents. And people personalize, right, these stories and their teams, and they represent almost, I think, a part of ourselves and a sense of accomplishment. And we sort of put into these players, you know, who we look up to as somehow being the people who come along in some way and make things okay for us.
I think so. And I think there's something I'm remembering now when the women's soccer team won the World Cup. And when Brandi Chastain, I think it was, when she scored the winning goal, she kind of rock star slid across the field and ripped her shirt off. And it was this big moment. We all had posters of it. And how as a kid, I wouldn't be able to articulate why exactly right now. But for some reason, as a kid, that was like this moment for me, like as a girl that liked soccer. And it was really empowering. So I definitely see, you know, there's so many different sides to it. We could probably go on and on.
It means so much, and people take this so personally. But what we're talking about today and what's so fascinating today is, what is it like to be on the other end of that, right?
Yeah.
What is it like to have so many thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of people watching you at any given moment and knowing the big business around this?
You saying that is making me anxious.
Well, I was in the Apple store the other day, and the Apple customer service representative was standing over me, and I couldn't remember my Apple ID, and I kept having to redo it, and I could tell he was getting annoyed with me, and I was
he's watching you do
even
it.
This
so
is
it makes
stressing
it
me out. I couldn't imagine, you know, being in front of hundreds of thousands of people.
That's like a nightmare, being in a stadium trying to reset your Apple TV, Apple iPhone with all these people watching you and cheering or booing.
Yeah. No, but
it might have been how it felt, though, under those fluorescent lights.
Oh, the fluorescent lights never help. Yeah. I'm not a big fan. No, so what we're doing today is we want to talk with Paul Shirley about what his experiences were like. And he's an amazing writer. He's working on his newest book that's going to be released in October and is known for writing these fantastic stories that are heartwarming and just genuine and funny and engaging about his experiences playing, you know, college and professional sports. And I think this is relevant because we don't really get an inside look at the psychology behind this. So we're very grateful to have Paul here today. And without further ado, Paul, thank you for being here. Welcome to On the Couch.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm intrigued to talk about it from this angle, because it's much more interesting than talking about it from the angle of, like, who's going to win, the Warriors or the Cavaliers, which I don't care about at all.
Yes, yes. Well, we want to know about your experience. So I'm wondering if you can start by telling us a little bit about when you first started getting into sports and what it meant for you, and at what point you began to think that you might want to pursue professional sports.
So similarly, I can remember my childhood being framed by the sporting heroes of the time, which for me were the Kansas City Royals. I grew up in a small town in Kansas, and my dad was something of a baseball fanatic. So we spent a lot of time going to peewee baseball games and going outside to play mm-hmm. catch and to, like, hit baseballs. And then as I got older, realized I had some acumen for hand-eye
I'm
coordination.
Really good at this.
Like, I could just do this a little bit more effectively than most people. And so when I was 10, if you had asked me, I would have said, I'm going to be a professional baseball player someday. Yeah. Then as baseball became the thing that I wasn't as good at, and because my dad was so into baseball, I found basketball as this thing I could do kind of on my own. I could go outside, shoot baskets by myself, and it didn't matter if my dad had been angry with me or if people at school didn't like me or whatever it was. I could exist by myself in the gravel driveway with just me, the ball, the net. And there was this piece of, and I think as you were mentioning earlier, there is this connection when you're playing that I think has to do with the fact that there are rules that are sort of just ingrained into the sport. If the ball goes through the net, it's a success. If it doesn't, it's not. And I think that people respond well to that. They love the fact that as our lives get more and more complicated, I think it's harder and harder to find positions where there are just rules. There's 40 minutes left in the game. The basket's always at 10 feet. And so that was something that I could control, was mm-hmm. being outside. I can control the fact that the ball's going through the net. I don't need to worry about whether my parents are fighting or whether girls like me or whatever mm-hmm. it was. And I think that the idea started to pop into my head once I started playing against other people, like, oh, I just seem to have this capacity for this that other people don't, and let's see how far I can take this. Additionally, there was some psychology there, too, of, like, I was starting to understand that people liked me better if I was good at this thing, right? Like, for whatever reason, they loved the fact that I could make baskets and that mm-hmm. I could impress upon this court my will or whatever it mm-hmm. was, that my aggression on the court would allow them to see something of themselves in me. Mm-hmm. Additionally, I liked the fact that I could, like, be this kind of bookwormy dork off the court and then get on the court, put on an actual different set of clothes and become this kind of proto-human, right? Like, I was a little bit caveman-y. I could switch into this other gear of being so emotionally attached to what I was doing and not having to worry about, like, these are the rules that society lives by. It was a little, I think compares to, like, how you behave sexually too, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's this time when you're just, like, throwing everything away.
Like, going into another dimension.
Yeah, so as soon as I stepped across that line, I didn't have to be the meek kid who liked to read books anymore. I could attach to, like, how I really felt in that moment.
Yeah, and I think popularity is so caught up with sports. When I was in grade school, like, the coolest guys were the ones who were good at sports, right? And you think of kids who maybe are more socially isolated as being kids typically who aren't as good at sports.
Especially
and it seems
men.
To be this sort of defining thing. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine how that was such a kind of a boost and something that gave you a sense of, you know, agency and control over your, like, life and experience. And
right. It is simple. It's the same reason I actually have said many times. So athletes get a reputation, especially professional and college athletes, for being stupid. I think a lot of times they're much more like rock stars, not rock stars, but musicians than people realize. Mm-hmm. Like, musicians figure out pretty quickly, like, oh, there's this loophole where if I'm good at playing this guitar, people are going to come watch me do this thing. With athletes, it's strange because we assume that these big, strong, oftentimes men will be also, like, socially gifted and everything about their psychology will be put together. But if you frame them as more like Kurt Cobain than you realize, then
That's
you start to see, like, oh, they're actually kind of screwed up in the head too. They're not as whole as maybe we want to
believe.
Not
all as easy for them as we think.
We create a narrative around this. You've been listening to On the Couch with Dr. Leanna and Margaret, here with our guest Paul Shirley, former college basketball and professional basketball player. We're going to be taking an inside look for the rest of the hour on what it's like to play professional sports. Stay tuned. 790 KBC Talk Radio.
Tired of that same old boring talk show? Then tune into So What's Your Problem? Stan Ketzer is guaranteed to make you laugh and help solve your real-life problems. Tune in Saturdays at midnight right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Spring fever is here. It's that time when everyone and everything goes crazy. And that's what happened to my sewer line. Yeah, that's right. 3 hours before a dinner party, it clogged and water backed up into the sinks. Fortunately, I did know who to call. SoCal Plumbers 911. SoCal Plumbers 911 is the referral service for the very best plumbers in LA. Here's how to get in touch with them. Go to SoCalPlumbers911.com or call 1-877-PLUMBER. They're offering $50 off your entire bill just to try them out. For any plumbing problem, remember 1-877-PLUMBER.
Where do you get the best soul food in town? I mean the best. I mean licking your plate clean, licking your fingers off. It's Doolin's on Crenshaw. Doolin's on Crenshaw, just south of Stocker. This is exquisite. This is Southern cooking at its very best. Southern cooking is the essence of home cooking. It's the essence of comfort food. It's the essence of patting your tummy and going, that was good, especially when you eat the mouth-watering fried chicken. Their fried chicken is something to dream about. It is just perfect. The skin, the crust, the spices, the herbs. God, it's good. The chicken inside is so moist. It's wonderful. Try the oxtails, the short ribs, the macaroni and cheese. It's for all your catering needs, for all your dining needs. They have their own catering hall. They will come to your house and set everything up. They will feed you so well. This is food you dream about. Doolin's on Crenshaw. And by the way, excellent customer service. The people at the counter are the best. At Doolin's on Crenshaw, just south of Stocker.
Cars, trucks, motorcycles. If it's got a motor, we've got your man. If there was ever a time you needed an automotive expert like Leon Kaplan at your side, it's now. The Motor Man. Sunday mornings at 8 on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Welcome back to On the Couch with Dr. Leanna and Margaret. Tonight, we are understanding the psychology behind college and professional sports, what it's like to be a high-level athlete. We are lucky to have our guest tonight, Paul Shirley, who played for Iowa State University and for 11 different teams in over 5 countries. And he is sharing with us some great stories about what it was like to play professional sports. Before the break, Paul, you were telling us about what sports gave to you as a kid and how you really felt this sense of empowerment in some ways, and it was an escape, and it was something that gave you a sense of control and self-efficacy. At what point did it progress to you playing in college?
So I think I had dreamed of, as I got to be a better high school basketball player, I started thinking like, oh, geez, I could go do this like my childhood heroes. There was this player at the University of Kansas named Danny Manning, who I had seen win the national championship in 1988 when I was, 10. And got to meet him in a Lawrence Walmart, got his autograph when I was the year before that, and was just awestruck by like this kind of God amongst us. And it was becoming evident that, like, oh, I could become one of those people. So I, through a long story that I won't bore everyone with, I ended up at Iowa State, actually on an academic scholarship, which is why when I'm trotted up in front of, like, classrooms, they're always like, make sure you tell them why academics is important.
Right, right, yes.
But the truth is that I have always in my life kind of used one thing to get to the other. So I used the PSAT. To get to college, where I was able to play for Iowa State, which was a Big 12 school, which means that it was a fairly major college and a fairly major conference, which was kind of the goal all along. I was hoping that I would get to play for one of these very big-time college programs. We were fairly successful when I was in college, won 2 Big 12 championships, and I was surrounded with guys who would go on to play in the NBA, guys who would play overseas. So it was kind of everything I had hoped it would be with regard to, like, the level of basketball. But there were also a lot of problems that were becoming evident as I got older and I started to become aware of my surroundings, just how much money was involved, realizing, like, these people that I'm playing for don't really care about me as a human. Mm. And I think that's where my, affection for sports started to split a little bit, where before I'd bought into the dream of it and saw, like, oh, this is all just rah rah hooray, like, this is so fun that all these, like, big dudes are battling it out on the court and trying to put a ball in a hoop. Mm-hmm. But now I was starting to see some of the pathology behind what was going on, and that caused me some cognitive dissonance. But I don't think I was even able to articulate that until well after.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Because I was 21.
Right.
And, like, who knows what's happening to them at 21 years old.
But you just started to feel kind of like something isn't right. The beautiful vision kind of started to – you started to see there's another side to it.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of it manifested for me in injuries, just the way that I was treated when I got hurt. And the first time that happens and you're like, I don't know if I'm – totally right yet, but I'm 19, so whatever, let's go out there and keep playing. But now it happens again when you're 20 and you have this stress fracture or something, and you're like, I would say, if somebody asked me, how do you feel, I would say bad, and I would say I need to sit out for another 2 months or something, but I don't want to be a sissy, and here I am, this big, strong, manly looking human. I'm not going to let all of these fans down, so yes, I'll go play and you can put painkillers into my body and we'll just keep doing that. And so, again, I don't know that I was processing that correctly at the time. I was just sort of like, I guess this is just what you do. And I should be thankful to be here, so I'm not going to rock the boat. I'll just, like, go along for the ride. I think this causes some problems because you're right that I am known for writing about my sports past, but people will get angry with me because I will write about how I felt in that moment, and they do not like that. Like, real, like, diehard fans do not want to hear about that because it introduces the same kind of cognitive dissonance. They don't want to think about, oh, that player on the court has feelings, and, you know, when his ankle is sprained and he's playing on it, that's going to cause, like, problems for him. I just want to think about him as a sort of automaton.
Yeah. Who do you think the fans and other people wanted or expected you to be?
So that was an interesting question for me because I was a white guy in Iowa on usually mostly black teams. So I was also held up as kind of the personification of like the hardworking Midwestern kid who will just sort of like put his head down and follow orders. I was not expected to be spectacular or anything like that. I was the archetype of like all these farmers in Iowa, right? Of course.
Yes.
But that is the culture in Iowa, is like, you know, this sort of rural vibe, and that's what I brought to the table. I'd come from a tiny town in Kansas, so I was sort of expected to be this like good aw shucks kid, and I think that's part of what has confused people after college. I was back at a game last year, the first game that I had gone to since I graduated 15 years ago or whenever that was.
Whoa.
And my college roommate and I sat down, and I saw there were people around us who had watched us play, and were like, oh my god, it's so great seeing you guys again, which was actually really heartwarming. Because in a way, it was very high schoolish. You know, these people were excited that we had come back and all that. And I saw somebody in front of me texting a friend like, hey, we're sitting right in front of Paul Shirley and Stevie Johnson. And the response to that was, well, that sounds cool, but I'm not much of a Paul Shirley fan. Because of all these things that I've said, I'm just talking about how I've felt afterwards. But people just don't know how to square that circle. Like, they can't fathom, like, why wouldn't he be the most thankful person in the world that he got to do this thing?
Right. So I can imagine what that cognitive dissonance must have been like for you, right? Growing up from the Midwest and thinking about these Midwest values. Mm-hmm. And I hear you alluding to the concept, I think, of humility and gratitude and,
right,
you know, doing what you're told and kind of going along with what's right. And I didn't grow up in the Midwest, so I can't imagine what, you know, the culture around this type of stuff, I think, is a little bit different now in
different.
LA, of course. But I can imagine that at that time in that place that people really had these expectations. And that's interesting to think about. Why do people need someone to be a certain way?
Well, and it's also interesting because I've just never thought of it that way. I always think of it as the pressure must be so much to perform. But I never thought of the pressure must be so much to fit into this kind of two-dimensional box of, you know, I'm the good farm boy representative for this part of the country. And then people don't want you to stray from that. And why do you think that is, Leanna, that people need athletes to be?
I know you asked the question of her, but
yeah,
I would say that a lot of it has to do, and it sounds cynical, but a lot of it has to do with money, right? So I can remember vividly that while I was at Iowa State, the engineering department, so I have an engineering degree, which was super weird for athletes. Like, most of them have non-degrees.
That seems uncommon.
So the engineering department was anxious to take advantage of this, and they actually made basketball cards of me that had my basketball stats and my GPA and how I did in college that they handed out at a game that they were sponsoring, right? Now, you could say on some level, like, oh, that's kind of positive. They're encouraging academics and athletics. But in reality, they're trying to get more engineering students. So they're utilizing this, again, archetype of like, he's the good kid who is also a good student. We need to use that to our best advantage. Like, when I was at Iowa State, there was one summer, the basketball secretary called me and said, hey, they want to make a commercial using you. So would you be willing to drive back up to Ames? I was at my parents' house for the summer. And they're going to make a commercial to sell the university. And the idea was, here's this guy who's good at sports and good at school.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did this whole photo shoot, la, 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 for this school that's taking in millions and millions of dollars, right, every year. And they were able to pay me per diem of $25 and I think gas money to get there and back, which is ludicrous when you start to think about it. Because you're like, well, this isn't Apple, right? But you guys are making money off of this. And so, I think as I was marching through this experience, I'm like, wait a second, This is not adding up.
Right.
No. Do you start to feel exploited at that point?
Yeah. I mean, I can't complain too much because I did get to go on to play professional basketball. And I've had like lots of things that I wouldn't have gotten because of it. Like because I played professional basketball player, very smart writer. But because I played professional basketball, that allowed me to start writing. And it has kind of led to all of these other things. I think that I mostly get frustrated based on other people I saw who were exploited and would be there for half a year, and then the coach decides, I don't have any use for you anymore, and sends them back to where they were, right? So a lot of the times people will say, well, you know, the guy gets a college degree out of it, so that's – well, no, they, a lot of times they don't get a college degree, or they get a worthless college degree that is in classes that the basketball team told them to take. So, like, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors there, too.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that at that age and at that time in one's life, you're still understanding yourself. Yeah. And you have all these expectations from different people and don't necessarily understand what the motivation is behind that. So there's the fans who you have to please. And back to your question, Margaret, I think people want to construct these narratives for their own psychological reasons about who they need their heroes to be. Mm-hmm. And it's something that it's serving for them. And I think there's something about not having that sort of synchronized that creates some sort of a psychological or emotional discomfort.
Or if you're too human, then you can't be perfect. Or you can't be, you know, if you're too human, then you can't, they can't flesh you out and make you the person that they need you to be or something like that.
Yeah. So you have the fans and then you have the university and then you have your coaches that you have to deal with who have a tremendous amount of pressure on their end and this sort of financial gain, right? And you don't have a whole lot of life experience during that time.
And you're probably maybe not psychologically flawed, but there's something that has driven you to do that thing to that degree, which is not entirely healthy, right? So, like, that's an additive to this whole mix, right, is that the individual players are not probably playing with, like, a full deck psychologically.
And yes. There's no, like, advisor that's all about holistic integration.
Nobody's like, okay, and then after practice we're going to yoga and we're going to talk about how we feel about this.
Yeah, no, that's not part of it. You've been listening to Paul Shirley, former college basketball player and NBA player who is now a writer talking about his experiences playing high-level sports. When we come back, he's going to be sharing some stories in his new book. Stay tuned. You're listening to Talk Radio KBC.
Wake up with Doug McIntyre in the morning.
Steve Zimmer, the president of the LAUSD Board of Education, pushed for these chicken rules over the chickens that are sold in the cafeterias have to be
cage-free and humanely raised.
And they have to have music
organic
in their lives. And
Ivy League education.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the kind of madness that chews up man hours and lawyers and preoccupies them. And meanwhile, they don't have books.
McIntyre in the morning.
Now with Leanne Tweeden News. 5 to 10 on KABC.
RTC. When your drains are clogged, your sink's backed up, your toilet's on the fritz. And when you need a plumber now, just simply call Ritz. We're master plumbers, we're really nice. We're big on service, not on price.
Call Ritz Plumbing at 888-757-RITZ. They're no rooter guys here, only full-service professional plumbers. You got a kitchen or bath problem? Need an earthquake valve installed? How about a tankless water heater? Well, Ritz Plumbing specializes in trenchless sewer repair, drain cleaning and maintenance, and yes, even rooter service. Plus, 12-month interest-free financing is possible. So call Ritz Plumbing, 888-757-RITZ. Ritz Plumbing, they're the real thing, only full-service professional plumbers. And here comes the clean pipe chorus. Hit it, guys.
So when you need some plumbing in California, yay, simply call Ritz. Don't flush your money away. Ritz
Plumbing, 888-757-RITZ.
Cars, trucks, motorcycles. If it's got a motor, we've got your man. If there was ever a time you needed an automotive expert like Leon Kaplan at your side, it's now. The Motor Man. Sunday mornings at 8 on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Welcome back to On the Couch with Dr. Leanna and Margaret. This is a show about psychology, and tonight we have a special guest, Paul Shirley, who has played, Paul, you've done tons of stuff. You've studied engineering, you've played college sports, you've played professional sports. Now you're a writer, you've written some great books, you're about to release another book in October. You run a writer's workshop here in Southern California called Writer's Block. You've gotten a lot done, and we've been talking to you about what it's like to play sports in that way, and the expectations and the assumptions and the pressures placed on you as this 18-year-old, 19-year-old kid from the Midwest who's just trying to follow instructions and kind of do what you're told and achieve and accomplish. And you went on to play for 11 teams in 5 countries over a few years, four years.
Yeah, well, the subtitle of that book is misleading because that book covers 3 years.
Okay.
And I did play for 11 teams in that 3 years, but I ended up playing for 17 professional teams.
Whoa.
Wow. And, you know.
Wow.
Which was a lot, guys. It was too many.
That's a lot of traveling. That's a lot of your time.
It's a testament to have my mediocrity as a professional basketball player. Michael Jordan did not play for 17 teams.
Well,
maybe he was lazy.
Lots. Yes, that's. I like that positive reframe. Lots of experiences.
Yeah, and he didn't get to live in Russia, which is something I
Well, that's exactly
for
right.
Him. I feel really sorry for him now.
Yeah. And share stories that people can relate to and identify with in, I'm sure, very personal ways. So having all this travel and all these experiences and pressure from fans and probably from family and coaches, I can imagine, was just so difficult at times. And you have a new book coming out called Stories I Tell on Dates. And in the book, you share a story called Double Heartbreak. And it sounds like it was one of the hardest days for you. I don't want to go so far as to say in your life, but it sounds like it was a pretty painful moment and experience. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that story and what that day was like for you.
So that is it's a reference to a newspaper headline that resulted from an iconic basketball game while I was at Iowa State. The short version of it, because the long version would take the rest of your show, is that we were a very good basketball team that year. We had a player named Marcus Fizer, who would eventually be drafted 4th in the NBA draft, and another guy named Jamal Tinsley, who was very good. And we spent the season sort of marching our way to becoming one of the best teams in the country, defeating the University of Kansas, who I had wanted to play for twice that year, and then made it all the way to the NCAA tournament. I, 2 or 3 games before the NCAA tournament, came down awkwardly in a home game and broke my foot. And this was devastating because I was, as a kid, you're hoping, you're praying that someday you'll get to play for a team that was as good as ours.
Mm-hmm.
And so going into the NCAA tournament, I was left on the sidelines, but I was rehabbing, and doctors and trainers were saying, like, well, if we win a couple of games, maybe you'll be able to get back and to play. And so we win our first 2 rounds in the NCAA tournament, and now we're in the Sweet 16. We're playing UCLA, actually.
You're almost,
go
Bruins!
Who went to UCLA?
Leanna.
I did.
Okay. She's the one
that's
so
smarter.
So we smash UCLA, and that sets up a game against Michigan State, who's the #1 seed in our regional, which I won't bore you with the details of what that means. But they're one of the best teams in the tournament, and we are a #2 seed. There are 8 teams left in this tournament. And before the game, the coach tells me, like, hey, you're probably going to play a fair bit in this game. So they shoot me up with Toradol, which is a painkiller that give you a shot in your butt. So I can't feel my leg anymore, which is sort of handy for not feeling the broken foot.
Probably
less handy
help.
For playing,
right.
You know,
NCAA.
So the
foot's still broken.
It's still broken.
You
just can't feel it.
Okay.
Yeah. Or the rest of your leg.
Wow.
So I go into the game, and I equip myself fairly well, and we're playing pretty well. And I'm running up and down the court in the second half, realizing, like, oh, if we keep doing this, we might go to the Final Four, which is iconic,
huge.
Right? Like, people know what the Final Four is. And
yeah.
For me, a kid who was a walk-on, which means I came on an academic scholarship, who's worked his way all the way up through the lineup and now is playing on this very impressive basketball team,
mm-hmm.
This is a big deal. And not only that, but my uncle is watching the game, and I'm thinking about how my now-dead grandfather would have felt about this. My parents can't be there because they were able to go to the first round games. But I'm doing all of this in front of a man I admire and in front of 22,000 fans, most of whom are Michigan State fans because it was in Auburn Hills, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And then with about, I think, like, 1.5 or 2 minutes to go, we're up by, I think, 2 points, and I come across half court, and my teammate flips me the ball, and I catch it in the middle of the lane, and I go up for a shot, and as I'm crashing to the ground because this guy has run under me, I see that it's popping through the net, and I'm like, oh great,
yes.
we're gonna be up by four, and when I make the free throw, we'll be up by five, and we're going to the final four. This is all happening.
Yeah.
I can't believe this. I still can't feel my foot, but I can feel the emotions of this is going to be successful.
Of the victory.
Yeah. So I get up, and sure enough, this ref over here is calling a blocking foul on the guy who has run under me, and I'm like, yeah, obviously he didn't give me any space to land. You got to give me some space to land. And then I see an alarming sight, which is the other ref coming over and saying, like, oh, I've got a charge, which means an offensive foul, on Shirley, the guy who shot the ball. So the refs huddle up, and they're continuing to huddle, and I'm starting to get a little worried because I've got four fouls at this point, right? And if I get my fifth foul, then I foul out of the game, which means not only that I will have no more agency on the proceedings, but also, like, my team will be better, will be worse off because I've played pretty well, and, like, this will hurt our chances. So then, sure enough, they report to the center of court, and they say, we've got a double foul, which is unheard of. Like, there's not – it's either a foul on him or a foul on me.
Right.
Like, there's not – there's no gray area.
They fouled each other.
But they couldn't – they couldn't decide, so they call a double foul. And this causes the, whatever, 2,000 of our fans to become incensed, but that is irrelevant because there's 20,000 Michigan State fans
there. So other people are cheering.
Right. So they give the ball to Michigan State on the alternating possession. They go down and throw this alley-oop for a dunk, and then from there it's all over. And so the game quickly turns, and Michigan State wins by five. Not before Coach Eustace, my coach, gets thrown out of the game, which is amazing because he was so mad at the refs for not only my call, but for a lot of other things that we felt like had gone against us because we weren't as cool as Michigan State.
I love how you say in the story that was the moment you liked him the
most. That was my that was my favorite Larry Eustace moment by a lot. And so in all of this madness of Eustace getting thrown out and the outcome of the game becoming clear, I'm at the end of the bench, and now the Tortalls wearing off and sadness begins to overtake my body. And I become one of those stereotypical kids at the end of the bench who is just beside himself in tears. I'm crying profusely, and cameras caught this, as they will do, right? Mm-hmm. So when we get back to Iowa, after I've kind of recovered from all of the chaos of the loss, and I'm starting to think, like, well, you know, I'm only a junior, and, like, we'll be back, or whatever other athletic cliche comes to mind.
Yeah.
I'm starting to think, like, well, you know, I'm going to get over this. My mom's calling me. She's telling me, like, hey, that picture of you is in the papers all over the country. And I'm like, oh, great. But I don't, I mean, whatever. I'm looking at it as, like, this is kind of funny now, right? And then by Monday morning, I have to go back to class because they canceled classes or anything just because we were good at basketball. So I walk to the dorm to eat breakfast where I eat every day. And as I'm walking through the door, I'm like, okay, just have a normal day, march through the school year, even though I kind of know that everybody's going to be thinking about this basketball game. Like, just head up, and they don't need to see your sadness. Walk to the newspaper bin to pick it up, and not only is my picture on the paper, but the entire front page of the campus newspaper is my face in tears.
What is wrong with people?
Double heartbreak under it, right? So then, so I'm like, well, I guess I could go back to sleep. But no, I'm going to be stronger than that and not let it get to me. So I walk to get my breakfast, and people are waving at me like, hey, Paul, that's a cool picture. Ha, ha, ha. So then I go in the middle of the morning to study on the in the Parks Library on the campus of Iowa State. And I will never forget the moment when I'm sitting there doing my engineering homework, which I'm behind on, I'm sure. And this girl walks up and says, are you Paul Shirley? And I was like, yeah, you bet, because, like, I'm interested in random girls coming up and talk to me. And she goes, will you sign this for me? And asks if I will sign her copy of me crying, which what's interesting about that to me is, like, to me, that's insane, right? Like, you have so little, like, decorum to think, like, well, this guy's probably not thrilled with his picture
but
on
he's
the paper.
Honest.
But in reality, from her perspective, it was I wasn't a real person. And that's, I think, one of those moments where I don't know that it hit me right then, but after I looked back at my college career, I was like, that's so emblematic of what was going on, where I was truly devastated that we had lost. I felt like my world had ended, which is not rational, but that's how I felt at the time. And it was wrapped up in coming back from injury and playing this game in front of my uncle, who I admire, and the fact that there's 22,000 people here, and I'm crying, and I can't stop crying, and I'm sad about the fact that I can't stop crying. But she sees me more as an avatar for everything that she felt about the game. So I signed her newspaper and sent her on
her way.
That
was so nice and kind of you.
There's no way I was going to explain all of that.
Of course, but that people don't get this. And you're right. It is about what you represent to other people and not about who you actually are. But I'm just thinking what it's like in those moments of your greatest vulnerability or despair to have that caught
and how much
for everyone to see.
Yeah, sorry, Leanna. I was really into the story. And how much you put in that wasn't seen, that other people don't see all the blood, the sweat, and the tears that go in there. It's like, well, that made me feel bad that you lost, but can you sign this?
Yeah, so kind of so clueless. And that's why we're doing the show today, because we want people to know what it's like. And living with this type of pressure and being expected to perform. Mm-hmm. And I think also that, you know, people listening to the show, firefighters and police officers and other people who are constantly on the lines each day going through these things, people in the military, people in the army who are expected to not have any feelings and to be perfectly strong and not have any of these vulnerabilities. And I think we have such illusions about what that means. You've been listening to On the Couch with Dr. Leanna and Margaret here with our guest tonight, Paul Shirley, talking about what life was like for him when he played college and professional sports, basketball in particularly. Stay tuned. We're going to be talking more about this coming up next. You're listening to 790 KBC Talk Radio.
Tired of that same old boring talk show? Then tune into So What's Your Problem? Stan Ketzer is guaranteed to make you laugh and help solve your real-life problems. Tune in Saturdays at midnight right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Where do you get the best soul food in town? I mean the best. I mean licking your plate clean, licking your fingers off. It's Doolin's on Crenshaw. Doolin's on Crenshaw, just south of Stocker. This is exquisite. This is Southern cooking at its very best. Southern cooking is the essence of home cooking. It's the essence of comfort food. It's the essence of patting your tummy and going, that was good, especially when you eat the mouth-watering fried chicken. Their fried chicken is something to dream about. It is just perfect. The skin, the crust, the spices, the herbs. God, it's good. The chicken inside is so moist. It's wonderful. Try the oxtails, the short ribs, the macaroni and cheese. It's for all your catering needs, for all your dining needs. They have their own catering hall. They will come to your house and set everything up. They will feed you so well. This is food you dream about. Doolin's on Crenshaw. And by the way, excellent customer service. The people at the counter are the best. At Doolin's on Crenshaw, just south of Stocker.
Spring fever is here. It's that time when everyone and everything goes crazy. And that's what happened to my sewer line. Yeah, that's right. 3 hours before a dinner party, it clogged and water backed up into the sinks. Fortunately, I did know who to call. SoCal Plumbers 911. SoCal Plumbers 911 is the referral service for the very best plumbers in LA. Here's how to get in touch with them. Go to SoCalPlumbers911.com or call 1-877-PLUMBER. They're offering $50 off your entire bill just to try them out. For any plumbing problem, remember 1-877-PLUMBER.
Talk Radio
77790 KABC.
Welcome back to On the Couch with Dr. Leanna and Margaret. We are talking to you about sports tonight, but not just sports in typical sense of the term. I don't know anything about who's winning or who's playing right now. We're talking about the psychology of sports and what it's like to be a high-level athlete playing college-level and professional sports and being in the NBA and the amount of pressure that goes into that. And we're taking an inside look at what it is to be a professional athlete and the pressures that go along with that. Here with us telling stories from his book that's going to be coming out in October, Paul Shirley, Stories I Tell on Dates, has been sharing with us some of the moments of vulnerability and hardship that he went through. Margaret and I have been here listening to you, of course, as, you know, therapists and psychologists. We're just thinking about these moments and what they must have been like and how they impacted you. And I'm curious, just hearing about all of this, how do you think that you coped all of these years with these pressures that you felt from so many different people in so many different ways?
A lot of really heavy music. That was my coping mechanism.
Yeah.
I was kind of lucky, I think, because I felt that pressure to behave according to some archetype that seeped into my brain. And I didn't drink in college and, in fact, didn't drink until I was like 27 or 28. Maybe and could have been like some level of self-knowledge that, like, because I think a lot of guys can take, there are alternate paths you can take to try to cope with what's going on. It should be said, too, that, like, these are obviously very, like, high-quality problems in a way, although I always try to, I tend to get modest about that, and I'll say, like, well, I'm lucky to get to do it, because that's how they teach you in sports,
that's
right?
That's what's expected from you.
But I sometimes don't know if it was, in fact, like, this is the sort of thing that angers people when I say this, when I'm like, I'm not sure it was worth it in the end, because, like, I'm dealing now with, like, body issues. My body took a thrashing. Mm-hmm. Like, you wouldn't know it by looking at me. It's radio, so you guys out there don't know this. But, like, I'm in pretty good shape, and I look fairly youthful, and, like, you wouldn't think, like, oh, that guy's, like, dealing with all of these broken bones and surgeries he had, and now he's having to, like, go to Pilates all the time just to try to rebuild this body that was wrecked by sports. And I didn't even do it to the degree that, you know, guys who played until they were 38 or 39. I stopped when I was 33, so it could have been worse.
Yeah.
I think that mental war caused me some issues in my, like, upper 20s, early 30s, where I was like, I'm having a hard time seeing if this is worthwhile. When I was younger, I think I just saw it as like, well, this is great. I get to be, I'm playing for the Chicago Bulls. This
I made
amazing.
It, right.
It's not real, right? You don't think, oh, these injuries are ever really going to come back around.
And... Well, and you guys could speak to this. I don't know how the psychology worked with regard to the fact that I was like constantly having to move on to the next thing. I didn't really have time to process what was going. So I didn't really think about like recovery. It was more just, well, a team in Greece wants me, so I'll go there now.
Yes.
And so there was a weirdly cumulative effect, I think. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It absolutely makes sense. And when we don't have time to process physical traumas, emotional traumas, wounds, because it's not safe to do so, or there's not the space or the time to do so, then this stuff kind of gets left open. I'm like picturing a filing cabinet in our brains with just files spread open everywhere with papers everywhere. And as long as those things are there, we can't really move on, right?
Yeah, it's also like I had somebody wise tell me during my career, now, Paul, look out. When you stop playing, you're going to be depressed for like 2 years. I was like, no, not me. I'm smart. I won't have that happen. I'm aware of what's going on. But sure enough, I had moved back to Kansas City, and I did 2 years of like twice weekly therapy to try to just figure out who I was without this thing that had provided me with an identity for so long. And that's, I think, fascinating to me because it's very weird to retire from something when you're 33.
Yes.
And theoretically at the prime of your life. Like it wasn't like I couldn't walk or something. Like I was still in great physical condition relatively.
Sure.
It's just that I couldn't do it at that level anymore.
Sure.
And so now you're stopping. And to be that good at something, not that I was that good, but I was pretty good, you have to, I think you kind of have to make it your bit of self-worth. Like I was talking to somebody last Friday about like how it just made, I just think about things differently. And that's what allowed me to do that. And that's really hard to articulate to people because they also want to believe, this is, I think, a part of the fandom, they want to believe it could be them out there.
Yeah.
And you don't want to go into the dark truth of like, look, homie, like, I'm sorry, but you can't. It's not good that my brain is wired this way, but it's what allowed me to do that thing.
Yes.
And I'm not sure you could do that.
Yes.
That's another thing people don't ever talk about because they're like, we're taught to be so humble and like filled with humility, but like, well, no, you could probably do that too. But
just
the truth is, like, no, you couldn't. And it has something to do with being 6'9", but it also has something to do with this other like screw being loose where I was willing to like throw my body in front of the equivalent of a train to try to stop him. And that's just not normal wiring.
So, and I'm curious about that. So you refer to it as a screw being loose. I'm curious about what you think the psychological profile or the personality structure is of a professional athlete who is able to do this day in and day out and sustain this level of pressure.
Well, so I think it takes a large degree of irrationality. You have to be willing to say like, well, I know I just missed 5 shots. But this one's going to go in, even though there's 20,000 people watching it or whatever it is. I mean, if you think about like an NFL quarterback, a lot of times they'll try to put a ball that's this big into a hole that's also this big. And they've screwed it up 4 times before that, but they do it again and again. I've talked about like, I think that's what leads to after their careers, like athletes don't make great decisions sometimes because we can kind of start to think like, I can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was blessed with these parents who kind of kept me grounded and who valued education. So I was able to sort of switch in and out of that.
Yeah.
But I always have that part of me that like sees things as possible when they maybe shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's really great. Like that has allowed me to take big chances on whatever, writing books or starting these things.
Yeah.
And will always serve me well in some regards. But there's a fine line where it doesn't serve you that well.
Would you call this as, so you're saying it's irrationality, or how about being overly optimistic, or?
Yeah, there's some of that. I mean, I would see that with the, what's strange about that too is like it takes being overly optimistic to do it, but being overly optimistic doesn't guarantee success. So I would be around guys very young who were like, dude, I'm going to make it. And you're like, well, you're 5'11". And you can't make a jump shot. I don't think that's going to happen. But that's required, but it doesn't necessarily guarantee success. So we're also training this whole group of people to behave this way, or we're encouraging that behavior. But then there's no real safety net, I think, psychologically when that doesn't work out. And they're like, whoa, I thought I was playing in the NBA, and here I am playing on the playground still.
Yeah, I think that's part of the promise, too, that we teach our kids with sports sometimes. If you just work really hard and practice, you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not always true.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you also have to be giant and willing to, like, go break a guy's nose just because he looked at you funny.
Well, I'm also thinking about the sense of purpose or hyper-focus or accomplishment, the ability to kind of stay one, have a one-track mind on the prize.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about what motivates somebody to stay so
persistent
over the years.
It's sometimes difficult for me to see. I mean, it's always difficult for us to see parents living through their children, right? Especially athletically. And I think that's one thing I wish I could get into the parent's head and say, like, look, man, I'm not sure that even your best case scenario is really good, right? So like your best case scenario, Joe Schmo, is like your kid's going to play professional baseball. But I'm not even sure that that outcome is going to make your child a better person, right? Or even being the star on his high school team, that may not make him the child you want him to be.
Yes, and I think you're right. I think it goes back to this narrative that we've constructed about who we need our kids to be, or our heroes to be, or the people we look up to. And I think we see that all as an extension of self, and it's some sort of psychological need that people are trying to work through themselves by putting that onto others. When you were playing for Iowa State, your coach was Coach Eustachy. And I've read in the headlines recently that he was under fire for creating a culture, I think, quote unquote, creating a culture of fear and intimidation and emotionally abusing his players while coaching at Colorado State University. It sounds like it was happening well before then. I'm curious what you think an amazing coach is versus an awful coach. The coaches who are really able to motivate and inspire their players, what are some of those common characteristics versus the ones who just use aggression and intimidation and abuse?
I think now that I'm older, I can see the commonalities a little better. When I was in it, I couldn't necessarily have picked that up. But so you were mentioning that you went to USC. My first college coach, Tim Floyd, was eventually a coach at USC. And I'm still very close with him, and got to see up close what it can be like when someone is able to be hard on you when they need to be hard on you, but patient when they need to be. And I think it mostly has to do with being okay with who you are. I think that what we see in sports, whether it's athletes or coaches, is people who are not okay and are seeking that fulfillment from somewhere else. And if that coach is mostly interested in being famous or the hoopla, they're probably going to be pretty awful to their players. If they're okay with who they are, they're going to be like, well, you know, we're going to win some. We'll try to win as many as we can, but I can be a decent human in the process.
Yes. Margaret, why are we not surprised to hear that? It's about having a strong sense of self, right? We talk about narcissism a lot on this show. And people who sometimes have the most fragile ego needing sort of the most strong defense mechanisms for self-protection. And that's what it's about. On a concluding note, we're running out of time here. Paul, if you could give advice to your younger self and to parents or young people listening, what would it be?
I like what you just said about finding that sense of being okay with who you are early on. I think I probably would have been a better basketball player if I had thought of it that way.
Sorry to interrupt. Paul, thank you so much for being on our show today. We've learned a lot. We hope that the listeners learned a lot about what it's like to be under this type of pressure. We're here with you every Friday night talking about psychology. For more information or to join our online community, visit us at facebook.com/onthecouchnow. We will talk to you next week.
We'll post Paul's book too, so you can check that out.
Yes, your book's coming out in October.
Yes, we will.
Where can people find it?
I will hammer you with details that you can post on the website.
It's great. Check it out.
Check it out. stories I tell on dates. Talk to you later.
This show furnished by Coast Psychological Services. Having